Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Paul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're here to shine a light on some surprising and inspiring places and what we can learn from them.
Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jaleel, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday the 7th of March, these are our main stories. A Hamas delegation leaves talks in Egypt that it was hoped would secure a ceasefire in Gaza as more reports emerge of children starving to death there. India's Hindu nationalist prime minister makes a controversial visit to the country's only Muslim-majority state, Kashmir. New data shows that last month was the hottest February ever recorded. Also in this podcast, a Hong Kong court lowers the bar for sedition, raising further concerns about freedom of speech, and why criminal gangs are targeting songbirds in Cyprus. As the situation in Gaza becomes ever more tragic, with reports emerging now of children starving to death, hopes had been pinned on ceasefire talks in Egypt. President Biden had talked optimistically about having a ceasefire in place this week, but instead a Hamas delegation has left the talks and Israel never even attended them, saying it first wanted a list of surviving hostages being held in Gaza. Hamas has accused Israel of thwarting attempts to reach a ceasefire before the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. Israel has accused Hamas of making unrealistic demands. Meanwhile, dozens of Palestinians are being killed every day in the ongoing Israeli offensive, which Israel says it won't stop until it's eradicated Hamas. Our correspondent in Jerusalem is Yolanda Nell.
Certainly the clock is really ticking now. This Hamas delegation have been in Cairo all week, meeting with Egyptian and Qatari mediators, but of course it's been remarked on from the beginning that Israel did not have an official delegation there, and it had said that it was waiting for a list on the surviving Israeli hostages being held by Hamas that would be included in this potential deal. Hamas had been saying that it was not possible with the ongoing Israeli bombardment and the communications problems in Gaza to come up with such a list without some kind of truce already being in place. And that did seem to kind of leave us in a stalemate from the beginning. And then on top of that, other complications came to light. Hamas was saying that really Israel had not given in to its demands for displaced Palestinians to be able to return to their homes. Of course, there's something like 1.5 million people who are displaced in Gaza, and the demand had been for those from the north to go back in particular, and also for a complete withdrawal. Hamas wanted that of Israeli forces from the cities in Gaza.
So you have this dire situation for many Palestinians in Gaza. We're now getting reports that children are dying from malnutrition from the Hamas-run health authorities in Gaza. The aid agencies that are desperately trying to get aid in are also concerned. Let's take a listen to James Elder from the children's charity UNICEF.
Remembering the north, if you look at the most vulnerable children, the youngest, the malnutrition rates there are three times higher than in Rafah in the south. That again speaks to what it means to get aid to these children. As I say, it's man-made, it's preventable. It continues to get worse, and it will get worse until we get a ceasefire and can flood the Gaza Strip with life-saving aid.
So despite all these appeals for Israel to allow in more aid, there still seems to be a big problem with helping the desperate people in Gaza.
Yeah, according to what we heard a day ago, about 258 trucks were able to enter to Gaza. That was an increase in what we've seen. But then the US was saying that, you know, we still need to see dramatically more go in. And the UN has been talking about 400, potentially 500 lorries would be able to enter if there was some kind of a ceasefire. The Israeli government has been insisting Israel's not imposing restrictions on aid, and it's facilitating increased shipments of food and medicines and other supplies. And it's been blaming the problems on poor UN distribution in Gaza. But we have seen, just as a measure of the growing frustration, all different techniques being talked about. Other countries, including the US, have joined the airdrops of aid into the Gaza Strip. And we're hearing talk of perhaps bringing aid in now from the sea.
Yolande Nell. We're at a critical juncture in the war in Ukraine. Kyiv insists that it is containing Russian advances as they continue to push on five different areas of the front line. But in the eastern Donetsk region, several villages have been captured after Russian forces took the town of Avdiivka last month. Kyiv has blamed stalling Western support for its loss of territory and lives. Our Ukraine correspondent, James Waterhouse, has been to the cities just behind the front line as people there prepare for what might be coming next.
So we've just arrived at a bakery in Kostantinivka, and as soon as we got out of the car, there was the thud of incoming artillery, followed by the siren. You never quite get used to it. You can only imagine what it is like to live through this day after day. And then you have this warm reception, a wooden panelled kitchen, the smell of fresh bread, the sight of them being loaded into an oven. There's a vast selection of pastries and bagels and pizzas as well, although it might be a bit early for that. Now, Darina runs this place, and she's really starting to feel the effects of this war.
Some staff left, and some people who we delivered our bread to also left. We used to work for Bakhmut, Soledar, and nearby towns. These places are now occupied. That's why we cannot bring our goods there.
Kostantinivka's main train station used to be a frontline hub, but it was hit by a Russian missile. There's still the smell of burning in the air. The arches along its front still stand, but the rest of the building's been heavily damaged. There are cracks and it's been burnt through. And across the road, gold panelling has been blown away from the towers of the cathedral. We're following Maria, Kola and Jesse the dog. They're walking to meet Maria's mum. And they have a difference of view over whether it's safe to stay.
We are tired all day. We have bad mood and panic attacks, constant depression. It's scary to go outside when we hear explosions. I think we have to leave.
And Tatiana, you know what I'm going to ask. Are you going to leave?
I've already left twice. What's the point? I still returned to where I came from. It's scary everywhere. Everywhere. Our whole country is on fire.
As the train rolls up to Kramatorsk station, tucked in between two cargo carriages to protect it from shelling, the sound of artillery in the distance is either a sobering reception or the main reason why so many are travelling the other way.
I came here to pick up some of my belongings. We hope we would come back home soon, but you see how it's going. A year ago, we hoped we would receive help from the West and the counteroffensive would work. Not anymore. People used to believe, but not now.
The train pulls away to the relative safety of the West. Eastern Ukraine is being eroded by Russian forces. The question is now whether the country and its Western allies are able to stop that.
That report by James Waterhouse. Let's turn to India now. And 5 years after he removed Kashmir's special semi-autonomous status, the Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi has been making a rare visit to the Muslim-majority state. Tight security has been in place with thousands of extra soldiers deployed for his trip. There's already a heavy military presence in the state after a decades-long insurgency in which tens of thousands of people were killed. Mr. Modi's visit comes weeks before general elections are due to be held in India. Addressing a rally in Kashmir's largest city, Srinagar, he said the suspension of the special status, Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, was good for the region, and he accused the opposition of using the issue to stir up trouble.
The Congress Party and its allies have misled the people of Jammu and Kashmir, citing Article 370. They misled the country. Today, there is no Article 370. Hence, the talent of the youth of Jammu and Kashmir is being fully respected. There are equal rights and equal opportunities for all.
I asked our South Asia regional editor, Ambarasa Natarajan, what kind of reception Mr. Modi had received in Kashmir.
Well, to quote one of the former chief ministers of the Kashmir region, Omar Abdullah, none of the people who attended this rally in Srinagar would have done so on their own free will. He said the people were being forced, especially government employees were being forced to come and attend this meeting to show that people have been overwhelmingly turning out for the meeting of Mr. Modi. And during his speech, he highlighted how various development projects brought in prosperity to the state, how tourists are coming back to this disputed region. And it was all about showing how normalcy has returned to the state, which witnessed very high level of insurgency, as you said. Tens of thousands of people had been killed over the years. But on the contrary, local Kashmiri leaders would point out how their personal liberty, restrictions on the movement of people have been having a negative impact on the region.
Kashmir has a special status, doesn't it? Because it is India's only Muslim-majority state. But Mr. Modi has been accused of mistreatment towards India's Muslim minority, given his Hindu nationalist agenda.
This special status was revoked in 2019. That triggered widespread protests in the region, and the Indian Supreme Court held that the move was valid in last December. So basically, that allowed even outsiders to come and buy property in Kashmir region, because that was one of the promises made when Kashmir was, you know, made part of India, to protect their identity and culture. That triggered a lot of heartburns for the people of Kashmir. Now, Modi is now trying to reach out to the Kashmiri people to say, look at the development in other parts of India, and that is what I'm going to bring in. But what local Kashmiri leaders would say is, we're also witnessing how the allegations of bias towards Muslims, how they are being ill-treated in other parts of the country. And in fact, the restrictions being put on the people of Kashmir itself, like, for example, press freedom, that is also showing a different story about how this government is treating the Muslim minority.
Ambarasan Etirajan. Here in the Northern Hemisphere, ski resorts have not been opening or closing early because of the lack of snow, and spring flowers have been popping up sooner than they used to. Now climate scientists are reporting that last month was the warmest February ever recorded. It's the ninth month in a row that global temperatures have broken record highs. Here's our climate editor, Justin Merlat.
Every month since June last year has set a new temperature high. At the same time, the world's sea surface is the hottest on record, and Antarctic ice has again reached extreme lows. The main driver of these events? Human-caused climate change. The concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere is the highest it's been for 2 million years, according to the World Meteorological Organization. This year, global temperatures got an extra boost from an El Niño event, which brings warmer water to the surface of parts of the tropical Pacific. It will weaken in the months ahead, which may bring respite from the current run of global temperature records. But so long as CO2 concentrations continue to rise, we can expect new highs in the future. Though scientists say urgent action to cut carbon emissions can still slow warming.
Justin Rowlatt. Now let's go to the Republic of Ireland, where people are set to vote on changes to the constitution regarding the makeup of a family and the role of women. And it's happening on Friday, which is International Women's Day. One of the votes is on the rewording of a paragraph written in the 1930s that refers to a woman's role as being, quote, a caregiver in the home. Well, clearly things have changed a lot since then, so we thought we'd look at the position of women in the Irish economy. My colleague, Leanna Byrne, has been home to Dublin, where she's been speaking to her mother and her grandmother about their experiences.
Hi, Gran.
Hi. Welcome home.
Thanks.
I'm Mary Flynn. I was Mary Breen, but you had to change your name in those days.
Would you have not wanted to change your name?
No, I wouldn't have.
Interesting. What's your name, Mum?
Nuala Byrne. I was Nuala Flynn. I was happy to change my name.
And I'm Leanna Byrne. So three generations of Breen / Flynn / Byrne women, I suppose.
Yes.
Yeah.
When you were young, what were the expectations for women?
You got married, had kids, you didn't get any say in anything. When you were married, you had to leave work and you couldn't go back. Things were taken out of your hands, you know. A woman was nothing.
Mum grew up in a different generation.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
I started work in 1976 and I was 18. I did go to school until I was 17 when I did my leaving certificate, equivalent to an A-level. I then started work in an insurance company. By 1977, they had to lift the marriage bar. And I actually worked with a woman. She was the first person in the company who left to get married and came back. And I have to say, it was quite controversial, particularly among the men who were complaining bitterly that married women were daring to come back and take the jobs of other men.
Do you ever feel like you were ambitious, but society around you wasn't really letting you be ambitious?
Oh, absolutely. In business, women did not rate, even when I was working. There were no women in the boardroom.
Even when I was in primary school and secondary school, people's mothers, either they were teachers or they worked part-time, but they wouldn't have had a career like yours.
Yes, I would agree. Most of them were still in the traditional professions, that nursing, teaching, as you mention. It's interesting, although most librarians are women, most of the heads of libraries were men. You can see now that lots more women are coming through, and that's a very welcome development. I think that's the difference. Perhaps you, as the third generation, have the opportunities and the expectations.
Nuala Byrne, ending that report by Leanna Byrne. Still to come in this podcast. We hear the story of two Afghan women who secretly sing about the daily struggles they face under Taliban rule.
What stories would you like to share with your daughter? What does she need to know to help her navigate her life ahead? Dear Daughter is the award-winning podcast from the BBC World Service, full of thoughtful letters of advice, personal stories, and life lessons for daughters everywhere. And it's back for a new series with more of your letters and more fantastic guests. Search for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. A pro-democracy activist in Hong Kong has had his appeal against the jail sentence of more than 3 years rejected by a court in the territory. Tan Tak Chi was arrested in 2020 after taking part in protests against a sweeping national security law imposed by Beijing. He was convicted of 11 charges, including uttering seditious words and public disorder. In dismissing his appeal, the judges said for a person to be found guilty of sedition, there didn't need to be any intent to commit violence, a ruling that could have far-reaching consequences, as our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, explained.
Well, the case in itself is interesting, particularly for the defendant, of course, but it's mostly interesting because of that ruling you mentioned there. It seems the judges have changed the definition of sedition as it relates to the law in Hong Kong. And as you pointed out there, they said in the future it was no longer necessary to prove an intention to violence. Now, that seems to completely broaden the scope of sedition. There are a number of cases involving this crime. This is a colonial era crime in Hong Kong established by the British. That's where it came from. So there are a number of cases going through the courts at the moment. And so that this ruling will affect those and make it, on appearance, easier to convict people of sedition because of what the judges in this case have said.
And what about the wider impact on freedom of speech in Hong Kong?
It seems it's got to have an effect. If you look at the definition of sedition, it's about uttering words or actions intending to encourage people to rebel against the government. What the judges have said is we can take out the rebellion bit of that definition. And so you're just left with uttering words or doing things which oppose the government. So you don't really have to think long and hard or for very long to realise that all kinds of things that you might say against the communist government in Beijing or the local rulers in Hong Kong could actually then be considered seditious. So, of course, anybody wanting to utter those words then will be less willing to do so. They'll be more restricted.
Mickey Bristow, industrial espionage is nothing new. And now it seems with all the excitement about artificial intelligence, companies will have to work harder than ever to protect their secrets in the AI boom. In the US, a former Google software engineer has been charged in California with stealing trade secrets about artificial intelligence while secretly working for two Chinese companies. Jiao De Silva in Singapore gave us the details.
It's a story that reads very much like a spy novel in the age of intensifying competition for AI supremacy. According to the indictment, Lin Weiding was hired by Google as a software engineer in 2019. A few years later, he allegedly began uploading information stored in Google's network to a personal Google account. Meanwhile, he was also spending time in China, where a startup tech firm offered him the job of chief technology officer and a salary of nearly $15,000 a month. He also started his own tech firm there with a focus on AI. The prosecutors say all of this was happening without Mr. Ding telling Google about his work for those other companies. Just before the end of 2023, Mr. Ding returned to the US, booked a one-way ticket from San Francisco to Beijing, and resigned. That's when Google really took action, searched his activity history, saw the unauthorized uploads, and alerted the authorities. Now, Mr. Ding stands accused of stealing more than 500 confidential files and faces up to 10 years in prison and $250,000 in fines on each count. The U.S. Attorney General says he was seeking to enrich himself by covertly working for companies that were seeking an edge in the AI technology race. And with the U.S.-China tech rivalry continuing to intensify, it's likely stories like this will only become more common.
Jiao De Silva. A movie set weapons handler who loaded a gun for the Hollywood actor Alec Baldwin before it went off and killed a cinematographer has been found guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Hannah Gutierrez-Reed was in charge of looking after the weapons on the set of the film Rust, despite having little experience. A jury in the U.S. state of New Mexico took just over 2 hours to reach a verdict.
We find the defendant, Hannah Gutierrez, guilty of involuntary manslaughter as charged in count one. We find the defendant, Hannah Gutierrez, not guilty of tampering with evidence as charged in count two.
One member of the jury, speaking outside the court, explained the reasons for their decision.
Pretty much it was just that never did the safety checks. Never checked the rounds to pull them out, to look at them, shake them. If you'd have done that, this wouldn't have happened. And lack of experience or whatever you want to call it, you took the job.
Alec Baldwin denies pulling the trigger and is due to face his own trial for manslaughter in July. Will Vernon is our correspondent in the US. He told Nick Miles more about the details of the case and the prosecution's arguments.
Hannah Gutierrez-Reed was an armourer working on the film Rust, so it was her job basically to look after the weapons that were being used in the filming. Now, prosecutors said that she unwittingly brought live ammunition onto the set and loaded one of these live rounds into a revolver that was being used as a prop. And that shot, of course, killed Galina Hutchins, a cinematographer who was working on the film, and injured another crew member. And Hannah Gutierrez-Reed was convicted a little earlier of manslaughter on the basis that she flouted basic gun safety guidelines, right? These apparently entail rudimentary checks to ensure that the rounds that you've just put inside a weapon are indeed inert, right? So they resemble real bullets on camera, but they can't be fired. And in closing arguments, the prosecutor, Carrie Morrissey, described constant, never-ending safety failures on the set of Rust and Guterres Reed's astonishing lack of diligence with gun safety. Now, there was someone else responsible for safety on set, David Halls, an assistant director. He pleaded no contest to negligent use of a deadly weapon last year. So he received a suspended sentence because he admitted that he failed to check the weapon properly.
Now, Will, there's been reaction from Helena Hutchins' parents and sister in a statement. They said, "We're satisfied that the jury, based on the evidence, found Hannah Gutierrez Reed guilty. We look forward to the justice system continuing to make sure that everyone else who's responsible for her death is required to face the legal consequences of their actions." Alec Baldwin is on trial in July for involuntary manslaughter himself, isn't he? What's he said about that sort of day back in 2021?
During this trial, Guterres Reed's defence lawyers tried to pin the blame on Alec Baldwin, saying that he pointed the weapon in the direction of Helena Hutchins and that wasn't in the script. So basically, Guterres Reed couldn't have known that he was about to do that. So Alec Baldwin was indeed holding the gun when this incident happened. But he says he was told there were no live rounds in the weapon. He denies pulling the trigger. He said he pulled just the hammer of the gun. But an expert later during the trial who examined the weapon for prosecutors said this gun couldn't have gone off, basically, without someone putting pressure on the trigger.
Will Vernon, now to Afghanistan, and we're going to hear from a couple of young women who are behind a very unusual type of protest. These two women sing songs in secret, wearing a blue burqa, and then post the videos on social media. It sounds fairly innocuous, but the songs talk about the struggles of women under the Taliban. And in a country where most girls are barred from school and most women banned from working, even this small protest is regarded as a crime which is punishable with arrest and possibly even death. Well, their videos have become increasingly popular, and other women in Afghanistan are responding with their own songs. The BBC's Kawan Kamosh has been following their story.
I think I have to take you back to Kabul almost 3 years ago when the Taliban was taking power and they surprisingly captured Kabul. I was there filming another documentary, and it was quite a surprise. And among other surprises was these women who started singing on social media, wearing burqas. At that time, it was really dangerous for any sort of voice of resistance. So women were the only groups who were protesting, and these women used online and Facebook to raise their voice. At that time, we were thinking whether it is safe to try to find them and talk to them. And it took us a long time to track them down and then see if we can speak to them. And they finally agreed to talk to us. This is what they told me. The first bit was the beginning of one of their first songs. They say we are going to sing this, but we're going to cost our lives. When we met them, they were trying to cover their windows, doors, to make sure nobody hear their voice, because what they are doing, it could be really dangerous for them. They told me that it could end up them being punished by death or torture, or at least getting arrested. So yeah, they talked to me about their sleepless nights and the threats they receive. One of the comments they were reading to me was about someone telling them that if they are found, they know how to remove the tongues from their throat. So quite chilling.
That report by Kawan Kamosh. Let's listen now to this sound from the natural world. Recordings like this one are being played by criminal gangs through speakers to lure small birds into nets or onto branches covered in glue on the island of Cyprus. More than 400,000 songbirds were trapped in this way last year and then sold to restaurants in Cyprus to be served as food. Martin Helikar from BirdLife Cyprus is campaigning to highlight the issue.
So the gangs are involved, the mafia are involved in Cyprus because there's so much money to be made out of trapping these songbirds to be served up as the traditional ambelopoulia delicacy in law-breaking restaurants. The tradition goes back a long way, but it's a tradition that's gone completely mad in Cyprus because of the introduction of tape technology. So tape lures draw in hundreds of thousands of birds to be killed. And this practice, whether the trapping is with lime sticks or with mist nets, is completely non-selective. So it's not just the target species that get killed. We know of more than 150 different bird species getting caught in this way, including bee-eaters, golden orioles, nightingales, and shrikes. So it has a serious ecological impact. We as BirdLife Cyprus have been campaigning on this for more than 20 years. And actually, the big picture is a good story. We've managed to reduce the levels of trapping dramatically since the 90s and since 20 years ago by more than 90%. What we've seen last autumn, though, is a serious blip, and we're really worried that we might be losing ground and beginning to threaten what has been a conservation success story. Basically, at the moment, we have a conservation success story that's under threat. So we need continued enforcement, we need the law relaxation to be reversed, and we need targeted enforcement against the big, organised, mafia-style trappers.
Martin Hillikar from BirdLife Cyprus. Scientists in Britain have found what they believe to be the world's oldest fossil forest, dating back 390 million years in sandstone cliffs in the southwest of England. They say the fossils reveal that the early trees grew up to 4 metres high. With more details, here's Richard Howes.
This ancient forest was growing about 150 million years before the dinosaurs ruled the Earth, in a geological age known as the Devonian period. Scientists from the universities of Cambridge and Cardiff say the plants were prototypes of modern trees. They looked similar to small palm trees but had hundreds of twig-like structures on their branches instead of leaves. Researchers say the trees were probably growing on a semi-arid plain along the banks of an ancient river. They existed at a time when marine life was rapidly diversifying and the first early land creatures, mostly millipedes and scorpions, were establishing themselves.
Richard Howes. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nora Hull. The producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.